KISU works hard to ensure the reliability of our FM signal, but occasionally, seasonal weather or equipment failures cause us to go off the air. Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Well, good evening, everybody. So glad you could be here for the Constitution and Love. And just so you know, love is constitutional, in case you had any questions about that. So this is the Alturas Institute's version of a Valentine's special. So tonight, we're going to, a little bit unique, tonight we're going to talk about various provisions of the Constitution and some famous Supreme Court cases that have, in fact, affected marriage, romance, love. And we'll talk about some Supreme Court cases that have delved pretty deeply into some important questions, some important historical questions ranging from the issue of polygamy to interracial marriage to same-sex marriage. And along the way, we'll tackle the great landmark case, Griswold versus Connecticut, in which the Supreme Court held in 1965 that married couples do have a constitutional right as a matter of privacy to use contraceptives. So we're going to run the gamut tonight. We've got love and romance and marriage, and who knows? We'll see what else comes up. So I'm glad you're here, and as always, I'm very happy that KISU is broadcasting this program. I want to thank our sponsors, including the Carr Foundation and Bank of Idaho and the Tammy Longaberger Family Foundation, Elizabeth Redleaf, Steve and Cindy Carr, Mark Young, Tim Hopkins, and a host of others. So we are a 501c3 for all of you listeners out there, and we welcome your support. Check us out at alturasinstitute.com. And now on to Constitution and Love. The place to start when we talk about the U.S. Constitution is to note that the Supreme Court has said that the institution of marriage is, in fact, a fundamental constitutional right, a fundamental right. Not all rights in the Constitution are regarded as fundamental. Fundamental rights are known as those which are truly vital to our system of freedom, vital to a constitutional democracy. In various areas, they would include the equal protection of the law, free speech, freedom of religion. And while no right is described in the Constitution as a quote-unquote fundamental right, it is left to the Supreme Court over time to define or to characterize fundamental rights. And that's what the Court has done over a couple of centuries with respect to marriage. So our starting point tonight is to talk about the first really important marriage case that came before the Supreme Court that had very important ramifications for freedom of religion, and particularly the Church of Latter-day Saints. And this is Reynolds versus the United States in 1878. Some of you are probably familiar with this case. And so it's important for us to discuss this both from the standpoint of the centrality of the doctrine of polygamy at that time, U.S. law, and the court's opportunity to define the parameters of marriage. So there's so much that could be said about this subject. I won't engage in a long historical dissertation, but let's suffice it to say that in 1862, Congress, which had absolute control over the territories, including the Idaho Territory and the Utah Territory, passed a law prohibiting bigamy and polygamy. The view from Congress was that it was not consistent with good social order, with good moral practices. There were, frankly, quite a few people in Congress who thought ill of the practice of a man taking multiple wives. Some thought it was immoral. Some thought that it was under the guise of religious freedom that some members of the LDS Church were resorting to what they called, quote-unquote, wicked ways. So you get the idea here that Congress was not particularly warm to the practice. At that time, clearly, there was a split within the LDS Church. A lot of people did not subscribe to the idea that polygamy was central to the practice. But the issue, as it came before the Supreme Court, involved the views of a man named George Reynolds, who was a polygamist, and he was a leader in the church, who said he believed that church doctrine taught the importance and the duty for men to take multiple wives. He went so far in his brief to the Supreme Court in Reynolds versus United States to say that if, in fact, men failed in their duty to take multiple wives, that they would be eternally punished for it. Now, George Reynolds' view of this and of the church and the doctrine and the practice of polygamy may have been skewed, but the court took it seriously precisely because of the reaction by Congress, the reaction before the 1862 law that we said prohibited polygamy, and also because the newly reformed Republican Party had in 1856 spoken out very strongly against the practice of polygamy, and editorial writers had spoken out against it. So the Supreme Court was in the position of taking what we call judicial notice, that is, the position that it is that the practice of polygamy was a central doctrine and that it was practiced in violation of U.S. law. That's where the case stood then when, in fact, George Reynolds violated the law enacted by Congress. And so he appeals his conviction all the way to the Supreme Court. And what does he invoke? He invokes the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. You may recall last week, those of you who were here, that we talked at length about the First Amendment religion clauses, the Establishment Clause, which provides Congress shall make no law establishing, no law respecting an establishment of religion or the free exercise thereof. Reynolds' claim was that as a matter of freedom of religion, he was entitled to not only hold his beliefs, his religious beliefs, but also to put them into action. And he believed that it wasn't enough simply to hold the beliefs in his head, but if he could not practice them, if he could not implement those religious beliefs that he considered to be of central importance, then he was being denied religious freedom. And what that line of argument would reflect, of course, would be another century in which the Supreme Court and lower federal courts would struggle to decide where do we draw the line between the right of an individual to absolutely hold his or her beliefs. You are entitled to your beliefs, your relationship with God and the universe, but there are practices, there are actions based on religious beliefs that the courts would not condone. And so that's been the history of determining the scope of freedom of religion. The court has never held that freedom of religion is an absolute right any more than it's ever held that any provision in the Bill of Rights is an absolute right. So here is Mr. Reynolds claiming a freedom of religion position, and that he believes that unless he's able to practice his religious beliefs that and implementing them with respect to polygamy, that he will have failed in his duty. A very strong claim. Chief Justice Waite writes the opinion for the court, and he rejects Reynolds' conception of freedom of religion. Chief Justice Waite writes in the opinion for the court that there is a difference between someone's religious beliefs, holding them in their mind, determining what their relationship is with God and their church, but some actions could not be condoned. And here he says the court cannot find support for the practice of polygamy. Why not? He reiterates some of the points that I've just made, that Congress has enacted a law in 1862 prohibiting the practice of bigamy and polygamy in the territories, embracing the fact that both Republicans and Democrats had denounced polygamy. Ironically, on that point, in the late 1850s, it was one of those very rare issues in American politics where Democrats and Republicans in the North and the South were united. They were opposed to the practice of polygamy. Lincoln's party was opposed. Stephen A. Douglas was opposed. The newly elected president, James Buchanan, was opposed. So there was not a lot of support for it. So in this vein, when the Supreme Court believes that it can cite all kinds of societal opposition to a practice, and of course embrace the fact that Congress, which has the authority to pass laws to govern the nation, has come out in opposition saying that polygamy violates what the court said is good social order, good social practices, that the court found it immoral, then the court can believe that it's on pretty strong ground in reaching the conclusion. He said, clearly everybody has to understand that there is a line to be drawn between a person maintaining views, religious views and values in one's mind and putting them into effect. Would it, for example, be acceptable if a woman, upon losing her husband, threw herself on the funeral pyre and burned herself to death in the name of religion? Would it not be believed that the government could prohibit a woman from doing that? What about human sacrifice? Would it not be true that the people would agree that the state could pass a law prohibiting human sacrifice, even if it was done in the name of religious freedom? So it would be relatively easy for the court to draw up hypothetical or perhaps remote practices as a means of demonstrating the logic that there must be some parameters, some limits to the exercise of freedom of religion. The court doesn't have to, for once and all time, define what those parameters are. No court would do it. But in this case, the court could determine that, in fact, the practice of polygamy was not worthy of religious freedom. It would hold out the question, as I say, going forward up until our time, as exactly where to draw that line. But in this case, the court was in pretty good ground. It was just a few years later, in 1890, of course, that the state of Utah, now moving from a territory to a state, would in fact pass a law to prohibit polygamy, and the LDS Church would, in fact, repeal the practice itself. Church leaders had a revelation that polygamy would no longer be acceptable. And so at that point in time, then, you had the U.S. Supreme Court striking down polygamy, you had the government in the newly minted state of Utah prohibiting it, and you had the LDS Church now perceiving a revelation to cease the practice. Even though polygamy then has no constitutional standing, it didn't mean, of course, that it ended, because there would be a pretty full history of polygamy in various isolated places in Utah, Arizona, Idaho, and elsewhere, and that raised the interesting question about why laws against polygamy were not always enforced or often enforced. And the simple answer was that often sheriffs just didn't want to have to deal with the question. They knew that there were multiple families living together, and the sheriff didn't want to become involved. Many years later, more than a century later, some people wanted to bring a case up the judicial pipeline to see if federal courts in our time were more amenable to the practice of polygamy, maybe in the name of a broader, more discretionary interpretation of the vital nature of a church's beliefs. But in a 2013 decision, a federal court continued to hold bigamy to be a crime. So it's not likely that we're ever going to see a court uphold the practice of bigamy or polygamy, because the courts, as you know, have defined marriage as a two-person institution. Notice I didn't say between a man and a woman, because you all know where the Supreme Court came down in Obergefell versus Hodges, which we'll talk about a little bit later, and that's in 2015. So polygamy was once at least regarded as a cardinal principle, and then within a matter of years rejected by governing authorities and the Mormon Church itself. So much for polygamy for a moment. Let's fast forward to a very important case in 1965 that greatly affected the institution of marriage. I think you'll find this interesting. So the case that I want to talk about is Griswold versus Connecticut. It's in 1965, as I say. And what the Supreme Court did in this landmark decision was to rule that married couples do indeed have a right to use contraceptive devices. At this point in time, in the state of Connecticut and in many states, in fact, there are laws prohibiting the use of contraception. And that would reflect a very old law going back to the late 19th century, reflecting a view, for example, in Connecticut and New York and elsewhere, that, in fact, sexual relations were undertaken for the purpose of procreation, and therefore there would be no need for married couples to utilize contraceptive devices. There would just never be a reason for that. There was, in essence, no consideration among legislators about the concept, let us call it, of recreational sex. It was all procreational. So the test for the utilization of contraceptive devices was not brought until 1965. You may notice that we're at an intersection of talking about women's rights, married couples' rights, but in fact, if we were to take a historical detour, we would note that, in fact, the first effort to launch rights for women had everything to do with the claim of women to have access to contraceptives. This even preceded it was argued in much the same voice as asserting a right of women to vote. Now, why in the late 19th century did women begin to assert a right to use contraceptive devices? Because without access to contraceptive devices, women were facing a history of bearing many, many pregnancies. In the case of many pregnancies, they would often lose the baby. Women would, in fact, become ill because their bodies were overburdened by years of multiple pregnancies. They would be worn out. The mortality age for women was at a low point. So there was a genuine health concern. Beyond that, women, early pioneers in this cause for rights of women to access to contraceptives, was also a function of the fact that women could not work outside the home. They couldn't go to school, so they believed that their futures were very stunted. So you have a number of reasons here. Education, employment, establishing a future, and of course these major health reasons, and not every woman wanted to have 8 or 10 or 12 children. So these were the early protests by women in states like Connecticut. But in Connecticut, and like other states, this sounds redundant, to say that these state legislatures were dominated by men, it's unnecessary to say that, the pleas by women were falling on deaf ears. And so a number of women started marching. They protested. Some were arrested. They were not making progress. This law, then, prohibiting in Connecticut, prohibiting the use of contraceptives, was a late 19th century law, and it does not get successfully challenged until 1965, when women are asserting, and when married couples are asserting the right. So how does Griswold versus Connecticut come before the court? A woman named Estelle Griswold, who was the executive director of of Planned Parenthood in Connecticut, along with a physician who worked on behalf of the league, were arrested for violating the statute. The statute had a couple of different parts. One said nobody can dispense contraceptives, otherwise you'll go to prison, and nobody can be involved in the delivery or the production of information to help people understand how they might acquire information about contraceptives. So not only was there a prohibition on the use, they were putting a lid on the opportunity to acquire information and even to prohibit the dissemination of information. So these two, as well as a married couple who had received the contraceptives from the doctor, in conjunction with a very, very good Yale law professor named Tom Emerson and some of his students, began the work to bring the case. They lost, of course, in the Connecticut courts, because when you challenge a law made by your state in state courts, it's like playing against hometown refereeing, if you understand the concept. So they appealed to the Supreme Court, Griswold versus Connecticut, and this is the famous opinion in which Justice William O. Douglas from Washington originally introduces the constitutional right to privacy. Nowhere in the Constitution is there any mention of the word privacy, and yet many Americans, even before this case, certainly believe that in a free society like ours, in a constitutional democracy like ours, we must enjoy some degree of privacy. But we would ask, exactly where does that right to privacy derive from? Where in the Constitution? If it's not in the text, where do we find it? So Justice William O. Douglas, whom I used to refer to in my classes affectionately as William O., from Yakima, from Whitman College, who had, by every estimation, a memory which never forgot anything. He had, according to many, a genuine photographic memory. He grew up in poverty, by the way, just as a quick bio. His father was a minister. They were very poor, and he was a brilliant student by every estimation. He wanted to go to law school back east. He was accepted, but he had no money to go there. So he decided ultimately that he would choose Columbia Law School in New York over Harvard and Yale. And how did he get back there? He rode the rails. He didn't have money to buy a ticket. What did he do? He waited for the train to come by, and he would jump on a moving train. And then, as he described it, the great task was to avoid the railroad bulls, that is, the railroad police, whom he personally had observed would throw people off. In those days, the free riders were called hobos, if you remember that old-fashioned term. Or sometimes they would beat the hobos terribly, sometimes killing them. So in addition to riding the rails, he had to avoid the railroad bulls. When he got back to New York, he had almost no money. He quickly found a job washing dishes. And then, very interestingly, because he was brilliant, he began to tutor law students even before he started law school. And that's how he obtained money. once he was in law school, then in fact his brilliance was recognized and the faculty found a scholarship for him. We could talk endlessly about William O. Douglas, and you may know, of course, that often very highly successful men and women write their autobiographies in a single volume. Well, William O. took two volumes to describe his enormous life. So we could talk at length about William O. Douglas. At any rate, in this opinion, in which he introduces, on behalf of the majority, a constitutional right to privacy, he addresses that question, well, if there is a right to privacy, where do we find it in the Constitution? Here's where Justice Douglas introduced the concept of penumbral rights emanating from enumerated rights. This might require a little bit of explanation. When we look at the Bill of Rights, we can see some that are enumerated. We would all look at the First Amendment. We would see right of freedom of religion and right of free speech, right of freedom of assembly. We would look further down the list of the Bill of Rights. We'd find other enumerated rights, such as due process of law and so forth. Justice Douglas said, well, there are those enumerated rights, but in addition, there are penumbral rights, rights that emanate from those enumerated rights, what we today might call implied rights. You can look at an enumerated right and assume that the enumerated right implies some additional rights. What did he have in mind? He said, well, first of all, look at the First Amendment, and it guarantees freedom of assembly, right? But it doesn't say anything about freedom of association, and yet we take for granted that we have a right or a freedom to associate with people, to determine whom we'll hang out with, and the Supreme Court agreed. So the Supreme Court found that in the freedom of assembly, there is a penumbral right, that is, freedom of association. He said, look further down the Constitutional Bill of Rights. The Fourth Amendment guarantees us, he said, a right to be free in our homes, our persons, our papers, from unreasonable search and seizure. From that, he pointed out, years earlier, the Supreme Court had identified a right to privacy in our home. He said, take a look at the Fifth Amendment, right against self-incrimination. The Supreme Court inferred from that a right to hold your tongue, not to surrender yourself to the government, a right to stay silent, if you will. He would go on to look at the Third Amendment, which protects us against quartering of troops. The government cannot quarter troops without our consent. There's a further examination of a right to privacy. When he looked at freedom of religion and free speech, he said, obviously, as the court has said, there is that little inner sanctum of our minds where we are free to think our thoughts, our religious thoughts, our political thoughts, any thoughts. The government cannot intervene. Therefore, there is a right to privacy drawn from or derived from free speech as well as freedom of religion. So as he looked at the Bill of Rights and he looked at Supreme Court decisions interpreting these various rights, he could determine that the court has already said that there are penumbral rights or implied rights. He could say then, speaking of marriage and contraceptives, that surely within our constitutional system there must be a right for married couples, as he used the phrase, in the sacred precincts of the marital bedroom, to make choices about this most intimate connection, this most intimate part of their relationship. And he went on to say that the state would not have authority to intervene to undermine this intimate connection between married couples. So he finds these penumbral rights, including the right to privacy, drawn from enumerated rights. And then he points out, and I'll come talk about this in a little bit more detail in a second, he points out the Ninth Amendment. The Ninth Amendment has some strange language in. It reads, quote, "The enumeration in this Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage other rights retained by the people," end quote. Here is a reference to, quote, other rights retained by the people. He says that we have a lot of rights listed, but we have also implied rights, and here we have other rights retained by the people. Here he says the purpose of the Ninth Amendment was to ensure that we would not be shortchanged by the short enumeration of rights that, in effect, the framers, principally James Madison, in introducing the Bill of Rights in the First Congress in June of 1789, intended to protect against the possibility that when he himself introduced all the various provisions that would become known as the Bill of Rights, that if he forgot something, if he overlooked a right, that we would not be denied that right merely because Congress had failed to include it. And ironically, he introduced what would become known as the Ninth Amendment then to protect against that possibility. And on that day, if you can believe it, he did forget to mention a pretty important one, namely freedom of speech. How about that? Of all the rights to forget, little Jemmy Madison, his name, nickname was Jemmy, Jemmy Madison, all 5'5", 130 pounds, always dressed in black, with a very weak voice, so weak that his colleagues were always saying, "Speak up, Jemmy, speak up." He forgot to include freedom of speech. Fortunately, his colleague Mason from Virginia said, "I'm sure Mr. Madison meant to add freedom of speech," and so the Congress added it. But the question always about the Ninth Amendment would be, well, what are those other rights retained by the people? And the Supreme Court itself would struggle over the years, but it would not deal with the Ninth Amendment for the first time until Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965. And here Douglas believes that within the matrix of our constitutional system, our free society, there must surely be some room to protect against the state's intervention. And then Douglas, as I said, from Washington, from Western Washington, with the earthy humor of a Westerner, could write in his opinion, what will police officers in Connecticut do? Will they peer through bedroom windows in search of telltale signs of violations of the Connecticut law? He had to have some fun with that one. At any rate, he writes that majority opinion. He's joined in a concurring opinion by his close colleagues, including Justice Goldberg and Brennan and others, and they support the idea that there is a constitutional right to privacy. Ironically, Justice Hugo Black, who had voted almost all the time with Justice William O. Douglas, dissents in this case in 1965. He writes in a dissenting opinion, "I don't disagree with any of the conclusions reached by my colleagues. I like my privacy as well as the next man, and I can't think of anything more abhorrent than the government determining that married couples cannot choose to use contraceptives if they so wish to govern their family, the size and the future of their family. But," he said, "I look in vain. I cannot find in the Constitution any protection for the right to privacy." That was an interesting opinion, and it reflected Justice Black's own jurisprudential approach to the Constitution. Unless the language mentioned the right, or unless he thought it was very clearly derived from the enumerated provision, he could not see his way clear to embrace that argument. With Griswold versus Connecticut, then, the state law falls, and now married couples are indeed free, finally, to use contraceptive devices. I hasten to add that the opinion only went to the use of contraceptive devices by married couples, not unmarried couples. Now, remember this time frame, folks. This is 1965, the middle of the 60s, the height of what we characterize as the sexual revolution. So you have to believe, I'm just going out on a limb here, I'm just guessing that there were probably some unmarried couples breaking the law. I don't know. I like to take a risk here, but I'm just guessing. There might have been some. It took 2 more years before a case came before the Supreme Court, and the court extended, as a matter of right to privacy, the right to use contraceptives to unmarried couples as well. And probably millions of people across the country breathed a sigh of relief then. That decision then held that marriage is a fundamental right grounded in those privacy provisions and also the liberty provision of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Let's take a look at that because this will play a very big role in what comes next. The 14th Amendment, ratified in 1868, a crucial amendment, the subject, in fact, of more litigation before the Supreme Court than any other single part of the Constitution, was designed by its framers to put blacks on par with whites in the eyes of the law. The 14th Amendment was the centerpiece of the Reconstruction Amendments, three crucial amendments. The 13th, which, as you know, abolished slavery. The 15th, providing the right to vote to the newly freed men, black Americans. And the 14th Amendment, which represents the engine of our constitutional democracy. Why? Because it guarantees due process of law, equal protection of the law, and privileges and immunities of citizenship. So the key language in the 14th Amendment says, no state shall make or enforce any law denying the right to life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So states may pass laws, may deny us our property rights, but only if we are granted due process. States may pass laws denying our liberties, but only if we're given due process, and that would require a court hearing, right? So here the court said in Griswold that the right to marriage, the fundamental right, is grounded in the liberty provision of the 14th Amendment. In other words, the court interprets the 14th Amendment liberty clause. No state shall make or enforce any law depriving any person of liberty without due process of law. And the court says, located within that sphere of liberty is the fundamental right to marry. The court grounds it in the liberty clause of the 14th Amendment. That becomes very, very important then for all the other court cases that will follow after 1965 involving claims to marriage. So we turn our attention then to Loving versus Virginia, the landmark case in 1967. Recently, the subject of a movie, maybe some of you saw it. It was called Loving. And here, the great issue of interracial marriage is brought before the Supreme Court. The state of Virginia, at this point, like 16 other states, this is 1967, still had a law that prohibited blacks from marrying whites. It had a law that prohibited interracial marriage. And this was a carryover going all the way back to the days of slavery, all the way back to the views, the hardened views, that blacks were somehow inferior, certainly not worthy of cohabitating with whites, certainly not worthy of marriage. And as the statute recited, the aim was to prevent, quote, the mongrelization of the race. The Integrity Act in Virginia said, the statute essentially wanted to prohibit interracial marriage to maintain racial purity and to protect humankind against the mongrelization of the races. Now, we don't have to belabor the point. This is obviously very backward thinking. But at one point in time, it was the dominant thinking because it was reflected in law. It was one of those laws that the framers of the 14th Amendment, in trying to move blacks beyond the chains, not only of slavery, but again over and above racial discrimination, was fighting against. Federal judges who heard challenges to the prohibition on interracial marriage, usually federal judges in Virginia, would defend the statute and say, God Almighty separated the races by locating them on separate continents. We have red people here, and black people here, and white people here, etc. That was the view of federal judges invoking religious reasons to uphold the prohibition on interracial marriage. And the judge said, if God had wanted the races to mix, he would have built bridges between the continents. A bridge too far, I would say. So that's what a woman named Jeter and a man named Loving were dealing with when they were married in 1959 in the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., where interracial marriage was legal. Then they decided to move to Virginia. That's when they got in trouble, because it didn't take long before people noticed that you have a black man cohabitating with a white woman. Excuse me, I said that backwards. Where you have a black woman cohabitating with a white man, and they knew that they were married, they were arrested, they came before the court. The first judge said, listen, you are violating a very important statute. I'm not going to convict you provided you agree to leave Virginia and never to return to the state for 25 years as a couple. Well, that seemed pretty harsh. Virginia had been their home. So they start the appeals process. When it reaches the Supreme Court of the United States in 1967, now Chief Justice Earl Warren, who had been nominated to the court by Dwight Eisenhower, and who had written the famous opinion in the landmark case of Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954, in which he struck down segregation in public schools with the famous language that segregation in public schools violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Here he is, back a few years later, writing the opinion for the Supreme Court. He goes on to invoke the reasoning that the court used in the Brown decision, that the Integrity Act, the Racial Integrity Act, violates due process and violates equal protection, and points out that, in fact, there's nothing to support, nothing in our Constitution to support interracial marriage. He takes a look at the state's arguments. The state was arguing, as we've just said, that in fact the separation or the segregation of the races was more or less divinely inspired. If God had wanted races to mingle, he would have built bridges among the continents. That in addition to that, the state had a very important reason. The rationale was clear. Whites were superior to blacks. We don't want to produce little interracial babies that will dumb down the population. And so the state was making what is called a police power argument. States have broad powers to pass laws to promote the health, the morals, the welfare, and the safety of their citizenry. That's what's known as the broad police power. And we see this all the time. States will pass compulsory education laws to promote the health and the education, the general welfare of our population. States will pass laws to require school kids to get immunization shots to promote the general welfare. A lot of the state laws are done for good reasons, for very healthy, caring reasons. Sometimes the police power is used in the most twisted way. Here it was being used in a very twisted way to keep the races apart. The court, then, in striking down the statute, held that marriage is a fundamental right and that individuals can make the choices for themselves, whom they're going to marry, with whom they want to spend a life, with whom they want to maintain intimacy. These are decisions that are grounded in the liberty provision of the 14th Amendment. Remember, 14th Amendment says no state shall make or enforce any law denying the liberty without due process of law. Liberty is broad enough that people, as a means of exercising their personal autonomy, can decide if they want to get married, whom they're going to get married. Well, they'll marry across racial lines, and the state rationales prohibiting it are not sufficient to deny or overcome due process and equal protection of the law. So here is a stunning decision. We might think that it was that long ago, but 1967 was just barely yesterday. And to think that late into our history that we still have laws grounded in racism is pretty disheartening. So we've made progress, right? Those statements then by the courts, and Griswold repeated in Loving that marriage is a fundamental right then, is utilized by the court in 2015 in Obergefell versus Hodges to hold for the first time that same-sex marriage deserves the same constitutional protections as any other marriage. So here is same-sex marriage then, which seemed to be moving at a glacial pace for so long in our history. Just 10 years ago, people who favored the right of same-sex couples to be able to be married thought it's going to take many, many years, and then like a flash, things heated up. And the courts began to uphold the claims, the lawsuits by same-sex couples, that they had a right as a matter of due process and equal protection based on Griswold, the fundamental right, based on Loving, the fundamental right. And before you knew it, in 2013 and 2014, the cases were moving very quickly at a pace that just shocked many people around the country. Many federal courts then, 35 of them across the country, began to render decisions saying that there's a constitutional basis for same-sex marriage. The federal district courts then were upheld by circuit courts, the federal appellate courts, in Midwestern states such as Michigan and Kentucky and others. And soon, the circuits that were upholding the right of same-sex marriage were greatly overwhelming opponents until a decision came out of Ohio in which the Sixth Circuit said that the Constitution does not support same-sex marriage. At that point, we now had a conflict among the appellate courts. Even though there was just one court saying that the Constitution does not protect same-sex marriage and a half a dozen saying it does, when we have a split among the circuit courts, that creates what is usually regarded as the very best situation for an appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court has very, very broad discretion to decide if it's going to hear an appeal or not, and justice after justice across the years will write or will say that the case most likely to be heard by the court will be a case in which the issue or the question on the legality or constitutionality is in fact a function of a split verdict of different opinions among the circuit courts. With this decision then, now the circumstances were ripe for an appeal to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court agrees to hear this case. It's very late in the term, in 2015. On June 26, just a few days before the court will end its term and justices will go home or go on vacation, Justice Anthony Kennedy writes the opinion for a 5-4 division. It's a landmark opinion upholding the right of same-sex marriage. And his opinion follows the logic of Griswold and very clearly Loving versus Virginia, that the authority of a state to deny same-sex marriage must be rooted in a compelling governmental interest to deny the assertion of same-sex marriage? What would be that compelling governmental interest? To protecting tradition? Well, the argument about protecting tradition only goes so far because that argument has the grounds for its own refutation. Because if all we ever did was to allow states to maintain their traditions, then states could continue to practice and protect all kinds of traditions, even those which are pernicious. So the argument about maintaining tradition has no currency before the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court has been rendering decisions changing the nature or the interpretation of law for 200 years. The argument made by the states was that marriage is an institution between a man and a woman to protect humans, to promote birth, to ensure the right of procreation. But that argument fell flat, too, because a lot of married couples choose not to have children or cannot have children. And so it could not be said that marriage was an institution designed to promote the size of humankind, that there would be other reasons for people to get married, including, as Justice Kennedy said, well, maybe they love each other. Maybe they enjoy this most intimate association. And the state could no longer make any health claims. For example, going back in the early to the mid-80s when AIDS, the disease of HIV/AIDS, was rapidly expanding, and initially there was a great high number within the gay community that no longer obtained by the time of 2015. There was a higher incidence of HIV/AIDS among heterosexuals. So that argument to prohibit same-sex marriage on the basis of the health of the community could no longer persuade. So the court could knock down these arguments, could knock down these rationales, but the arguments in favor of same-sex marriage were compelling. Kennedy, in writing the opinion, was able to draw upon his previous landmark decisions upholding gay rights. So he would say that equal protection of the law now protects same-sex marriage just as it protects opposite-sex marriage. And the reasons why people would be married, might get married, would be the same as heterosexuals. And there, since there were no persuasive arguments against it, and given the fact that the court had already said in Loving now that the right of liberty in the 14th Amendment was broad enough to protect adults in making choices, that there would be no justification for denying same-sex couples that same constitutional right as a matter of due process and equal protection of the law. It was a 5-4 decision, close split, about as close as you can get, right? The decision probably surprised many across the nation, but if you think about the rapid pace of federal courts, federal judges of both parties, Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals, citing the previous case law, the court's previous interpretations of due process and equal protection, it was, in my view, an outcome that was left only to a matter of time. With that decision, then, same-sex marriage becomes as protected as a heterosexual marriage. All the rights that heterosexual couples enjoy as a matter of marriage are extended to same-sex couples. The court then began in Reynolds with the statement that marriage is indeed a fundamental right, but how it would be applied, what its manifestations would await time, would await court cases, would await further Supreme Court decisions. It's not clear where the institution of marriage will go forward, how it will go forward, where it will go, over the foreseeable future, but it seems to me that probably the court has had its great word on the right of all Americans to choose whether or not they'll be married, and if they so choose, then they will enjoy all the rights that everybody else enjoys. Thank you. So I spent a little extra time talking, but that's what happens if you're an academic. It takes 5 minutes just to clear our throats, so it's what you should expect. But now I hope there'll be some good questions. I welcome questions from students, as always. They're always great. And Kelly has the microphone. So right down here, Kelly, please, if we can speak up loud and clear into the mic so we can get that. Thank you. Can you speak up for the radio a little bit more, please? Just speak a little louder. Oh, just a second. Is the mic not on? There we go. Thank you.
In the Griswold case, right. Was there any role of the pharmaceutical industry?
Well, that's a very good question. So companies that produce contraceptives, variety of contraceptives, would certainly have an interest, an economic interest in the outcome of the case. That much is true. So they earned a victory. But as to whether or not the pharmaceuticals or other similar companies played a leading role, I don't know. I've never read that in any of the articles or books about the case. It's a very interesting question. Yeah, thank you. Where else? In the back there. Thanks.
I don't have a question. I just want to clarify something. You said that the LDS Church rejected the practice of polygamy through a revelation, but that revelation given that the church leaders gave was that members were to discontinue polygamy and obey the laws of the land, not that they did not believe in it still.
Not any longer to believe in polygamy, just to cease the practice?
Correct.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for that clarification. I appreciate that. So that would mean that people would still have, as a matter of freedom of religion, the right to think their thoughts, hold their beliefs, their relation to God, and so forth, but they would not practice some of those beliefs. Thank you very much. That's a very nice point.
So my question is about the recent decision by the Trump administration to not defend transgender cases in respect to Title IX. And so I was wondering about your opinion about whether the language in Title IX actually protects transgender folk or whether it should and how it could be changed to do that.
That's an excellent question. So you've seized upon a very important aspect of the Trump administration's program. I do believe that Title IX does protect transgendered citizens. And so we already know that there are challenges to the Trump program. I fully expect that the court's going to hold that Title IX, which protects sex or gender, will in fact be held by the court to protect transgendered souls as well. Good question. Thank you. Talking about bringing the issues right up to the moment. Thank you. These are really important issues that sometimes are a little unsettling, and they reflect radical changes in our society. So I appreciate your questions and comments. Please.
My question has to do with laws that may be outdated, that may still be on the books. The one that I'm thinking of was back in the 80s and 90s, there was a law in Idaho and may still be against fornication or sexual relations between unmarried people. And there were some overzealous prosecutors in some of the counties who wanted to bring charges against specifically teenagers and convict them of fornication as a way to punish them for having sex. So I was working for the health department at the time, and we were concerned that we could be drawn into this conflict because our records would be subpoenaed from our family planning program and from our STD program, and that it would it would turn into a big, ugly deal, and some of us would end up going to jail. So my question is, what happens to laws like this that have been on the books and may still be on the books? And if someone decides to suddenly, you know, prosecute people under these laws, you know, what are the chances that it will, you know, eventually go all the way to the Supreme Court? Yeah. This could hinge on not only contraception but also the abortion issue. Mm-hmm. And I understand we have a bill being debated now in the Idaho legislature that gets a little iffy as far as privacy of medical records and that sort of thing.
Thank you. Those are really extra interesting questions. So for the first concept, I have several layers of answers. Thank you. So the first thing to note is that every state still has laws on the books that are no longer in force. They just have not been removed. Yet what we really need to do is to have legislatures scrub the books, so to speak, and repeal the laws, right? In Sweden, by contrast, there is a doctrine, the doctrine of desuetude, which said if a law is not enforced after a period of years, it just dies a natural death, actually removed from the code. We could use something like that. But those, I like your question about the potential implementation or enforcement of some of these laws. They can be utilized by an overzealous prosecutor wanting to make a name for himself, looking to run for high political office, finding an interesting cultural or moral issue to exploit for his or her own gain. That happens all the time across our country. So we would hope that if some of those laws that prohibit certain forms of behavior are in fact exercised, that on appeal the courts will strike them down for violating maybe due process of law. When you mention the abortion issue, we want to remember that that the right to privacy introduced in Griswold versus Connecticut was in fact at issue in Roe versus Wade, the landmark 1973 decision, where the Supreme Court held that there's a fundamental right to an abortion. The court actually grounded that in the Liberty Clause of the 14th Amendment, shying away from invoking privacy, but grounding it in the liberty provision. What was that? For those of you who have read the case or thought about it, the court says that the liberty provision of the 14th Amendment is broad enough to allow a woman to make the most personal choices regarding her reproductive organs. As a matter of liberty, we're talking about personal autonomy. So the court found within the liberty provision this concept of personal autonomy. And of course, Idaho has a history, the Idaho legislature has a history of passing a number of laws that have either attempted to undermine Roe versus Wade or to circumvent them. And these laws, without exception, have been declared unconstitutional, thus costing Idaho taxpayers a lot of money when there is no likely chance, no plausible chance of prevailing. And why legislators continue to do that is a little bit amazing. Because for this reason, just looking wherever you stand on the abortion issue, the Supreme Court of the United States is not going to overturn Roe versus Wade. As former Senator of Pennsylvania Arlen Specter, a conservative Republican, said years ago, Roe versus Wade is now a, quote, super-duper precedent. I like the technical term there. Super-duper precedent. He believed that the landmark opinion in 73 is so well entrenched that it would not be dislodged. And in part, that doesn't mean that some individual members, even newer members to the court, aren't opposed to it. It's just that the court is interested in stability, doesn't want to reach back in time and undercut a decision, let alone take away what the court itself has described as a fundamental right and upset the apple cart. Sow seeds of instability and unpredictability in an area which has been governed now. So how long is that? They don't let me teach math. 45 years or so, right? So that's unlikely. And that happens in other areas as well, that justices who might have a complaint are reluctant to move back and try to disturb or overturn a precedent. Although, to be fair, two members of the current court, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Sotomayor, have said, if we find a precedent which is wholly without foundation, then we should not allow it to persist, that we should correct what they call judicial error. And that was in a prominent case known as Citizens United, when in that case, in a dissenting opinion, Justice Sotomayor said that the concept that corporations have the same free speech rights as individuals is based on essentially a very spurious foundation, grounded in an 1886 Supreme Court decision which attributed to corporations the protection of the 14th Amendment. And it's a fascinating story how this occurred. In this decision, when the Chief Justice was Waite, the same fellow who wrote the polygamy decision, when the clerk of the court, who was responsible for drafting the headnotes or the syllabus of a case, for those of you who read cases, you'll see preceding the opinion several short paragraphs that capture in just a few sentences the key elements of a case, the summary, a syllabus sometimes called the headnotes. It's a quick way to get a good grasp of the essence of what the court's doing. Well, this clerk for the court had written these headnotes, come to Chief Justice Waite. Waite's reviewing them, and he says, well, what is this one saying that corporations are entitled to 14th Amendment protections? He said, the court didn't hear this issue. There was no argument on the issue. But he says to the clerk, but I suppose we all feel this, that corporations are entitled to 14th Amendment protection, so we'll leave it there, even though there's no mention of that point in the body of the opinion. So when this was discovered, it was pointed out that no single member of the court can authorize a headnote which is not the subject of oral argument or written argument, and it was an abuse of power. But it is nevertheless in there, and that's been the foundation ever since, for the argument made by corporations that they have 14th Amendment protections. It was in the Citizens United case then, as I say, that Justice Sotomayor points out it's time to re-examine that argument. And Chief Justice Roberts, to his credit, said, yes, if in fact our law rests on an erroneous precedent, we should correct it. So there's a chance that a case more than 100 years old, or a doctrine rather, which is very much a function of judicial error, could be re-examined. But I don't expect we'll ever have a majority on the U.S. Supreme Court that will be willing to overturn Roe versus Wade. That's a very long-winded answer to your question. Thank you. Other questions? Right here. Oh, okay, thanks.
If gay rights is illegal, how can states say that, in some states, that gay people can adopt?
Right, good question. So once the decision was handed down on same-sex marriage, it was understood that within time, all those state laws that represent discrimination between or among same-sex couples will have to fall. But there would be, as you well know, there would be a number of reluctant states, cities, counties that are still opposed to the concept that are going to drag their feet on the implementation of equal rights, that is, rights protected under the Equal Protection Clause, which will necessitate lawsuits on many issues at different stages to ensure that the rights of same-sex couples are equal to the rights of heterosexual couples. We still see reluctant county clerks, for example, refusing to fill out the paperwork of a same-sex couple. This takes time. One thing about our system is that the judicial decisions are not self-enforcing. The courts always rely on the executive branch to enforce the decisions. The executive branch would be from the president on down to sheriffs, and recalcitrant sheriffs and others can drag their feet and slow the progress. That was the story of Brown versus the Board of Education, if you recall. After the court in 1954 held that segregation in public schools is unconstitutional, it persisted for many years because there were many clever ways of avoiding its implementation. Thanks for that question. That's a good one. Oh, yeah, please.
I just have a question of clarification and something that I've never quite been clear on, and that is, what is the legal difference between polygamy and bigamy?
Yeah, thank you. So they're virtually the same. The act of bigamy is if a person is married to another person and marries somebody else at the same time. That's what bigamy is prohibited. That's what bigamy is. Polygamy is having multiple wives, let's say, or multiple husbands that are not, in fact, legally married. So you might have two or five or whatever the number is. Yeah. Yes, sir.
In relation to the ban on contraceptives, and I am amazed that it took until 1965, actually, but Anthony Comstock, attorney or the Postmaster General, a real blue nose. I understood he was actually opening people's mail. Could you comment on that and how he relates to the
right
decision? And isn't opening people's mail by the government illegal?
So the effort was used to mail to circumvent the laws, and then the Comstock Act was passed to prohibit the use of the postal system to mail contraceptives. So there are always ways of trying to circumvent the laws, right? Always ways to try to promote or obtain your rights, your opportunities, and it's one side working against the other to see who can be more clever, who can be a little bit more innovative. Yeah. Where are we? Oh, yes, please. Well, I appreciate that question very much. So I would always say, as I would say to you or anybody else, so let's pursue that. I'm interested in wondering what specifically you have in mind. So if there's another, and I'd like you to respond if you have something in mind. So don't go too far, Kelly. If you have in mind, quote unquote, another side on a free exercise issue, let's say, would you be speaking, for example, about polygamy, for example, or...
Well, I'm quite well informed about the Idaho Constitution and their extending far beyond practice. It was, but if you believed in it, or if you were a member of a church that at some time believed in it.
Sure.
That's one example you might comment on.
Yes, so thank you. So let's take a couple of different issues, because I'm always interested in rounding out the discussion. So when I was presenting what the Supreme Court ruled, for example, in Reynolds, I was talking about the court's position and its reasoning. The opposition, of course, which would be George Reynolds' perspective, was pretty simple, that he thought that the free exercise clause, freedom of religion, should allow him to practice his religious beliefs as he saw fit, or in accordance with what he perceived to be church doctrine. So that's a very important argument. And I mentioned going forward that there would always be an argument as to the scope of religious liberty. We would always have arguments over how far does religious liberty extend in the case of polygamy, or, for example, going forward to a couple of companion cases in 1940 and 1943, when members of the Jehovah's Witnesses refused to salute the flag as a matter of religious liberty because they said our religion teaches us not to pay homage to a graven image And in our religion, the flag is considered to be a graven image. So the students, the children of Jehovah's Witnesses, refused to salute the flag even though there was a state law requiring it. And when the state law was upheld in 1940, people said, well, what about religious liberty? Why are you going to make the Jehovah's Witnesses violate their religious beliefs? The court's view, which was very specious, I think indefensible, was if children don't salute the flag, then our national security will be imperiled and the nation will come to its knees. So I could make fun of that decision, but it comes to your point that there would be different views about the scope of religious liberty. And what the court has tried to say, for better or worse, since it began to interpret the free exercise clause, is that there's no such thing as an absolute right. No right's absolute. Rights have to be exercised in conjunction with other concerns such as social order. And that's where the court opposed polygamy as a violation of good social order, which is to say the justices thought it was immoral.
And I as far as the LDS Church, that's kind of a non-issue now.
But not there an issue is, any longer,
but,
right.
But there is still the problem that, well, say, for example, you mentioned that HIV/AIDS is prevalent among heterosexual.
Right.
But as I recall listening to the reports, still the greatest increase of HIV/AIDS is with young men, and it has been for a couple of years because I've listened to who've had sex with men. And yet, can I write a letter and say that, or will I be
sure.
Will my freedom of speech be restricted?
Oh. Yeah, very
it's
good
called political correctness.
Well, I appreciate that question. So, of course, you can write that letter. And of course you can offer your opinion, and no authority is going to deny your right to express it. So no matter what we would think of political correctness, you're not going to be stopped from expressing your opinion. If you express that opinion, then people might pull out the data to say, well, you might be wrong in your numbers or your conclusion here. Or they might say, well, even if you can say that there's still a large number of HIV cases among homosexuals, it's also true of members of the heterosexual community. So long as, let's say, there's a lengthy list, maybe a shortened list, but a sufficient list of those who have contracted HIV who are heterosexuals and gays, then the justification for prohibiting same-sex marriage will have disappeared because you already have heterosexuals that are contracting HIV as well. So you'd follow those kinds of arguments, but no, you'd certainly have every right to express your views. And I certainly would believe that any time people are censored and denied their opportunity to protect their right to free speech, then that is a grave blow against our constitutional system. All people should be able to express their views, and I know you have, and I hope you'll do it more. Thank you. Do we have a question back in the... Yeah, Paul.
Dr. Adler, the progression of cases you've described goes from freedom of speech up through personal liberty, et cetera, up until Obergefell.
Uh-huh.
So are we going to see a decision that comes out that says polygamy is now protected by the U.S. Constitution as a matter of association or the 14th Amendment?
Yeah. Well, that's a very good question. And some people want to contend that in light of court decisions that there'll be renewed efforts to try to protect, as you say, as a matter of association or personal consent, the right of adults to choose to be to have 10 husbands or 10 wives. It can always be brought back. We would have to see, first of all, the state laws that prohibit bigamy. Now, that can be gotten around as a matter of the practice of polygamy if people aren't really just married, they're just cohabitating. And that's one reason why sheriffs and other law enforcement officials are reluctant to try to prohibit people who may be practicing polygamy but who are cohabiting, when in our time we have lots of people living together. Go around to any city in America and find 10 people in a house, right, of both men and women. So it becomes difficult, but there would be some who would contend that they are practicing polygamy as a matter of the free exercise clause, and if a case did reach the Supreme Court somehow, they would ask the court, overturn Reynolds versus United States and let us have multiple husbands and multiple wives. Possible, but I don't think it's likely, because it would require the court to reverse itself on some pretty important issues. Let's just show of hands. How many of would you like to see the court reverse itself and say polygamy is grounded in the First Amendment? That a man should be able to have 20 wives and a woman should have 15 husbands, right? Well, I don't know. That's a very good question. Lynn? Just a second, if you don't mind. Look at Kelly move. Thank you. Getting your exercise. Yes, please.
I've been in conversations with many actually young people who believe that polyandry should be a right. And it is different from a man and several wives. It is three or four or several people who commit to a life together. Mm-hmm. And that's a different thing than polygamy or bigamy. And I would differ with you in that I think that there may be a time when that becomes a more accepted consideration, and we might find that our mores will change with it.
Well, that's a very good point. I've been wrong before many, many times. I could be wrong here. And it may be that over time, as people decide that they want to live in what used to be called communes, right? Many relationships, multiple relationships. To go back to Paul's point, freedom of association. And I guess unless you're a Supreme Court justice and you're striking down those kinds of relationships, at least till this point, on what is considered good social order, good social practices, for lack of a better term, immorality, you're exactly right. Mores change over time. Look at the sexual revolution, a grand change in mores. Look at all kinds of social changes. So I'm just saying at this point that it would be hard to see any time in the near future. Let me protect myself. I don't expect to see any court now upholding it beyond tomorrow. I'll go out on a limb. So, yeah, we could see changes, and it may very well. Good point. Where are we? Over here, please.
Right here.
Oh, thanks.
I'm a little conflicted.
Join the rest of us.
We live under the concept that we're one nation under God. Mm-hmm. How would you respond to the comment that the judicial system is an unholy institution?
Unholy. Well, that's an interesting question. How would I respond to the description of the judiciary as an unholy institution? Well, I've been very disappointed in the judiciary on many occasions. I think we all have, right? Probably not going to go so far to say it's unholy, but certainly worthy of harsh criticism on any number of cases. You know, just Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 78, in defending the institution of judicial review, said that judges would not use the bench to promote their own views, their own politics, their own values. The opponent in the debate, a man named Yates, Robert Yates, who was writing under the pseudonym called Brutus, said, however, no, he fully expected that judges would abuse their position, abuse their power to promote their political and their economic and other agendas. So after two centuries or so, we could ask, who had the better part of the debate, Hamilton or Yates? If we can all summon our list of 10 or 15 Supreme Court or federal judicial decisions with which we disagree, we might think Yates was right. But let's look at it over the long term and see. In the next century, let's gather again and see how we feel about that about that question. Certainly, you can look at devastating decisions by the judiciary, such as the Dred Scott decision. And probably everybody here could muster a list of four or five decisions. It doesn't mean that the institution of the judiciary is unholy or worthy of damnation. And it might, in fact, be worthy of more praise than the other two institutions lately. Just wondering.
In recent years, there have been many states that have come up with constitutional amendments for the state, and courts have declared a constitutional amendment to be unconstitutional. Now, is there such an ability that the Supreme Court could overturn a constitutional amendment at the federal level and declare that to be unconstitutional?
That's a very important question. The Supreme Court or federal courts as a whole can indeed strike down state laws and state constitutional amendments if they are in conflict with federal law, because the Supremacy Clause states that federal laws, treaties, and the Constitution are the supreme law of the land. But you don't have to worry about any assertion of power by the federal judiciary to strike down part of the Constitution, because the judiciary, even though sometimes it doesn't behave so, to your question, the judiciary is still subordinate to the Constitution, so it cannot strike down any part of the document from which it derives its authority. It's the creature. The Constitution is the creator, so to speak, or the master. So we wouldn't have to worry about that, but definitely with respect to state laws and state constitutional amendments. And let me give you examples as far back as 1909, when the state of Colorado passed a constitutional amendment to its state constitution denying the federal courts the power of judicial review, the federal courts struck down that part of the Colorado Constitution, interested in protecting its power. But the states may not deprive the federal government of its authority, because our hierarchy is such that the Constitution's the supreme law of the land, then the federal government is superior to the state government. So the state governments sometimes get the short end of the stick. And that's governed by the 10th Amendment. Yeah. Good, interesting question. Thank you. I think we're out of time then. So thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thanks for coming. I appreciate that. Thank you for your good questions. I hope that you will return next week for the last of this five-part session, when we talk about the state of the Mueller investigation and talk about such critical issues as executive privilege and what the impeachment power would mean, and most importantly, the scope of the congressional power to investigate the executive branch. So thanks. I hope I'll see you next week.